From the halls of every school in Michigan, this is School Talks on 760 WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy. Sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran, Real Point, Collins and Plaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now, take your seats. Class is in session. Here's Robert.
As the second half of the school year continues to unfold, we have a great lineup on the program today featuring Michigan Department of Education Superintendent Dr. Michael Rice. From Oakland Schools, we have literacy experts Christina Carlin and Diane Katakowski. And from Warren Woods Public Schools, literacy coach Rochelle Barkley. All this and more coming up. This is School Talks on 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now in the program is State Superintendent for the Michigan Department of Education, Dr. Michael Rice. Welcome to the program, Dr. Rice.
Thank you so much for having me.
I appreciate your time today. So, among all the things happening in education recently, one thing I think is really important that people be aware of is the work that your department has been doing to develop a strategic plan. As I'm aware, it's been going on for some time. And could you share with us a little bit about Michigan's, what you know it as, the Top 10 Strategic Education Plan? And more importantly, why is it so important?
Sure. So I appreciate the question. The Top 10 Strategic Education Plan was approved by our State Board of Education in August of 2020 after community stakeholder engagement with approximately 10,000 Michiganders over a year's period of time. There were surveys, there were interviews, there were focus groups. We ultimately came up with an 8-goal Top 10 Strategic Education Plan, and those goals are what we use to focus our activity, our funding requests, and our efforts to drive higher student achievement in the state.
And, you know, you mentioned it was it began in 2020, correct?
Right.
So the year that preceded that in the information gathering stage, this was actually right in the middle of the pandemic, correct?
Correct. So we began our work in August of 2019, the month that I began in the position. We did our strategic planning work in part through the pandemic. There was a little hiatus there. And then the board approved the Top 10 Strategic Education Plan August of 20, about 5 months into the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. So since it began, what would you consider are some of the major changes or improvements that have already been made since its inception?
So the Top 10 Strategic Education Plan, 8 goals, two of those goals are upstream resource goals, addressing the teacher shortage, number one, and addressing adequate and equitable school funding, number two. They affect everything else resource downstream. And then we have 3 goals, which are developmentally upstream. They are to expand preschool, the governor's universal access to preschool, goal one, to improve early literacy, number two, and to improve health, safety, and wellness, number three. They affect everything developmentally downstream. Do a better job with kids early. As you know, you get better outcomes from them later and into adulthood. And then you have goals 4, 5, and 6, which are more outcome related. Goal 4, the expansion of secondary school programming, APIB, early middle college, dual enrollment, CTE, and transition services for students with disabilities, the improvement of graduation rates, goal 5, and the improvement of post-secondary credential attainment rates, the governor's so-called 60 by 30 goal. Mm-hmm. And those are more outcome related. So do a better job with resources, you do a better job with outcomes. Do a better job with early, you do a better job with later. As you well know from your experience in public education. So in terms of points of pride, we have added young people who are preparing for the profession every year in the last 7 years. We've gone from 9,500 people preparing for the profession in educator prep programs to more than 16,000, an increase every year in the last 7 years, number one. Two, we've gotten universal breakfasts and lunches, an increase in the number of breakfasts served last year by 26%, an increase in the number of lunches served by 20%. We've added $1 billion of funding to address the teacher shortage, which was rife pre-pandemic, which was exacerbated by the pandemic, and we are a leader in the nation in addressing the teacher shortage. $305 million for scholarships or fellowships, $175 million for Grow Your Own programs, $50 million for student teacher stipends, $225 million for teacher loan repayments, $15 million for a rural credentialing hub to help rural educators get over that certification barrier, and $50 million to address mentoring and induction, not only for new teachers and new counselors, but also for new principals and new superintendents. So those are points of pride as well. You may recall that for much of our careers, there was nothing in the State School Aid Act, precisely nothing for children's mental health or school safety. What we did over a period of years, the education community, LEA leaders, ISD leaders, State Department of Education, the State Board of Education, was we pressed the legislature and the governor to go from nothing in the State School Aid Act for children's mental health and school safety to what is now about $250 million in the State School Aid Act for children's mental health, just above $250 million. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's perfect, and it is a consistent struggle or challenge in the budget process to retain those dollars. But boy, it's a whole lot better than during most of our careers.
Yep. We're currently with Dr. Michael Rice, the state superintendent for the Michigan Department of Education. You know, Dr. Rice, how you have categorized the different areas of support for this strategic plan, I would really view them as what many would consider are the most important pillars that hold up public education, whether it's funding for preschool, keeping children fed in school, and safety and wellness in that. And when I consider a strategic plan that has those kinds of pillars and the improvements that you're making, you guys are off to a really good start at maintaining this plan, given, in one respect, how it's able to change based on the conditions on the ground, so to speak. So, you know, as school safety ramps up or depending on funding changes and that, the plan itself seems nimble enough to be able to weather what is coming before the state as we move through this transition. So I couldn't be prouder to watch how this is unfolding. And just one thought on your end, from a literacy perspective, could you talk a little bit more about the governor's preschool initiative and how it has sort of parlayed into your plan as a demonstration of this responsiveness?
Sure. Well, so there are a few things. First of all, goal one of the top 10 strategic education plan is to expand preschool access. We want to have every child whose parents have an interest in them attending our Great Start Readiness Program preschool program, first in the nation in quality. We want every child to have that opportunity. We've increased the number of young people in GSRP preschool. We've more than doubled the number of kids in GSRP preschool in the last 15 years. In the last 3 years, an increase of 52%. Preschool, as you know, is an enormous benefit to early literacy. An extra year for young people as they are growing, and particularly growing intellectually, cognitively, is tremendously beneficial to literacy outcomes. We think that the more young people, all else being equal, in preschool, the better we're going to do in terms of literacy. That said, the pandemic was a challenge, and it's not simply about increasing preschool. It's also doing discrete things to improve literacy. So, for example, we've got 10,000 teachers that have either finished letters training or are engaged in letters professional development training, so-called science of reading training. This is intense professional development to help teachers teach literacy better. That's a major effort. And then another major effort is what we did in the state legislature. After 5 years of working with the legislature and others, we were finally successful in getting the legislature across the finish line with PA 146 and mm-hmm. PA 147. These two literacy/dyslexia laws will require screening 3 times a year, K-3, for children for characteristics of dyslexia, and will require interventions where those characteristics are found. Will require screening 4-12, grades 4-12, for children as necessary. Will require improvements in pre-service and in-service professional development. Will require the department to determine science of reading, early literacy series, and professional development efforts, and will require our local school districts to choose from among those lists. Mm-hmm. We believe that these efforts are going to narrow and deepen and strengthen the work that we do with young people in literacy, and like other states that have pursued a similar course, are going to improve literacy in the state for our young people.
That's fantastic. If you'll stay with me, I want to take a short break to hear a word from our sponsors, and when we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit more about the future of the plan and some of the exciting things coming forward. So stay right there. This is 760 WJR.
This is School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy, sponsored by Wakely Associates, Plant Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Once again at the head of the class, Dr. Livernoy.
We're back here with Dr. Michael Rice, State Superintendent for the Michigan Department of Education, talking about the state's strategic plan known as the Top 10 Strategic Education Plan and all of the important factors it contains in supporting public schools. So, Dr. Rice, before the break, we were talking about the different goals of the plan and whatnot. And one thing, I had the opportunity to review the presentation you recently gave to the State Board of Education, and some of the improvements in there are pretty impressive when you consider the number of students who are taking advanced placement courses, and especially the improvements across different groups of students. And I'm curious, through the plan, are there programs or materials that reflect the cultural or linguistic diversity of students?
Without a doubt. Yeah, without a doubt. The effort from the department, and I would argue from many local school districts across the state, is about all children. And with respect specifically to advanced placement participation and success, we began a couple of years ago to write the parents of students whose PSAT scores suggested the likely success in advanced placement courses. And we wrote parents and we said, good news, your child's PSAT results indicate that your child is likely to be successful in advanced placement courses. These are rigorous courses. which, if successfully completed, have a capacity to generate college credit. So you can earn high school credit, you can earn college credit, you can raise your arm, you know, you can reach for a higher height in your education. We sent 41,000 of those letters 2 years ago. We sent 90,000 of those letters last year. We sent 81,000 of those letters this year. And we believe the drumbeat, not only around advanced placement participation and success, but career and technical education, dual enrollment, early middle college, international baccalaureate, we believe that this is responsible for the fact that there are increases in each and every one of these secondary school programming areas. We're doing a terrific job across the state in increasing the rigor of our young people, and specifically with respect to children of color in advanced placement courses. We've had a two-year increase of 28% in black students, 26% in Hispanic students, 24% in students of two or more races in terms of their AP participation. In addition, we've had big increases in terms of the number of students, percentages of students of all ethnic groups getting a score of three or more, which is a score that often, not always, but often generates college credit. So I feel strongly about these letters. We're one of two states in the nation whose state education agency sends these letters out statewide. Connecticut and Michigan are the only two. Sometimes you see a local school district do it. I did it when I was a local school superintendent in New Jersey back in the day when I was young and you were younger. I didn't do it in my second district. I drumbeat around advanced placement in a different way when I was superintendent in Kalamazoo. And then this is a riff off of what I did early on. It's an LEA strategy taken to the SEA. It's a local school district strategy taken to the state education agency.
Yes, Dr. Michael Rice, state superintendent for the Michigan Department of Education. I want to first congratulate you on the continued good work with this strategic plan. And I want to thank you very much for joining us on the program, and keep up the good work. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I appreciate it. And I appreciate you.
Right after the break, we'll be joined by literacy experts Christina Carlin and Diane Katakowski from Oakland Schools. We'll be back right after this.
School Talks on WJR with Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now in the program from Oakland Schools is literacy consultant Christina Carlin, along with speech and language consultant Diane Katakowski. Welcome to the program, ladies.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So in our continued focus on the program about literacy, how does Oakland Schools work with all of the local districts in the county? Either do you as a group go to local schools, or do they come to you? Or how does that relationship work with the individual districts?
So at the heart of Oakland Schools is really serving our families, our educators and leaders, and most importantly, the students of Oakland County. So we really take on that service leadership mindset. And so what that means is that we really develop collaborative partnerships with all of our districts and schools and public school academies. And we work to seek innovative partnerships with them. And so we really listen about what it is, the problem they're seeking to solve, where they might need to support. And then from there, we develop a plan of support with them. And so that might mean that they come to Oakland Schools for some professional learning or workshops, some time for their district leadership teams, or it may be that we go out to their districts to support them there. So it's really designed to be meeting districts and schools where they're at, and taking on that service mindset. In everything that we do, we're seeking to support and serve leaders in order to accelerate accelerate the growth and learning of educators, and then ultimately the growth and learning of the students in our school communities.
And you know, for parents and educators who are paying attention to literacy, there has been a lot of discussion in recent years about what we should be teaching children, how we should be teaching them, and so on. And I grew up and learned literacy primarily through phonics. Mm-hmm. And as you well know, there was a wave of research and practice that moved away from it. And I can remember having conversations with my parents who were sort of dumbfounded by the fact that some places moved away from phonics, maybe not entirely, but to a certain generation of people like my parents, it just didn't make sense to them. And I know in recent years there's been quite a debate over how to teach literacy in schools. And I think an important point in this for people to remember is, as our culture has changed and transformed because of technology and all kinds of things, so too should how we prepare children. And I remember a few years ago, a family member of mine asked me about, have you heard about something called Sold a Story, which was this uprising of parents who were concerned about how their children were learning literacy and whatnot. So with that as a backdrop, what are some of the more popular evidence-based practices in literacy?
So I think that's a great question, and I think you bring up a really important point about the impact of technology and social media, and that has had a tremendous impact on our students and their growth, but it's also had an impact on our educators and our leaders. So in today's age, there's access to so much more research and mm-hmm. science about brain development, about what our readers need. So yes, there has been some media coverage, certainly the pandemic, and parent insight into what their students are doing in school during that time of virtual learning has given them a deeper insight into how their children are learning how to read. And I think ultimately at the core of that is this idea of collective responsibility and a deep sense of urgency to do better for our kids. Mm-hmm. And we all, whether you are an educator at any level, early childhood, high school, secondary, we all have that shared interest about meeting the needs of our students and helping to improve those student outcomes. So here in Michigan, we've been fortunate to have some really great leadership at the state level. So in 2016, the Literacy Essentials were developed, which are based on that convergence of evidence of what we know students need in order to be effective readers and writers, listeners and speakers. And so we really use those Literacy Essentials. So there are 10 practices that are research-based to move the needle on student achievement. Those are curricular resource agnostic, so no matter what tool you are using. And we really, at Oakland Schools and throughout the state, really, we lean into those literacy essentials. There are pre-K essentials, there's disciplinary literacy for the secondary level, and we lean into improving instructional practices in those areas in order to improve student mm-hmm. outcomes.
So Diane, from the county perspective, how do you support districts who end up with a mix of students from a variety of skill levels? How would you approach something like that?
Absolutely. Well, I think the research that we heard commonly before the COVID-19 pandemic was that in any classroom, you could have a range of students working plus or minus 2 years from that grade level, right? So if I'm teaching third grade, I might have kids who are reading and writing at anywhere from a first grade to a fifth grade level. Now, I haven't seen anything published recently, but I would guess that the range is even greater sitting after the pandemic. So we try to build in supports around very clear and consistent instructional routines that are shared by all of our educators. So that's another important thing we have to do is we have to be collaborative. We are smarter when we work together. We can synergize our efforts when we work together. So when our general education staff, our special educators, our interventionists, our administration is all on the same page, that can be really crucial in moving the mark. When our instructional routines are grounded in very clear, consistent, explicit ways of interacting, then our kids know what to expect. It's not a surprise. They can focus on the content. They don't have to worry about what's coming next.
Sure. We're currently with Christina Carlin and Diane Katakowski from Oakland Schools talking about all things literacy. So in that same lens with student ability levels, I would imagine that the non-native speakers of English have a substantial impact on your work, either at the county level or the work that's going on in the local school. Is that a fair assessment? And how does that play into what you mentioned about the ability levels?
Yeah, so it's really exciting to think through what the landscape of our classrooms look like right now in the state of Michigan. I think the most current data from myschooldata.org shows that about 6% of all student enrollment is made up of English learners, families or individuals who identify as speaking additional languages. In Oakland County, we have a little bit greater percentage, right at about 8%. But in our local districts, we range anywhere from 1 to almost 80% of our student enrollment in some of our locals. So the variety is clear. We also, the languages, it's not just like there's one or two languages. We have over 120 languages being reported in Oakland County. So what we know from the research is that multilingualism and cultural linguistic diversity is actually an asset, not just to the speakers of those languages, but it's an asset to the community and to our classrooms, because we're learning from each other in a variety of ways. What's great about the literacy movements happening in our state and in our classrooms, I think, is that they are founded on really teaching students, well, developing teacher understanding, deep knowledge, and experience with how English language works. And then teaching kids how English language works. And we can do that with an asset mindset towards the other languages in the classroom. So you might have speakers of languages in your classroom. We want them to continue speaking those languages at home. We want to encourage families that's how their kiddos are going to learn to read and write English, is by speaking, listening, reading, and writing their home languages. Some of those languages don't have written systems. That's okay.
Sure.
That's when they know their language real well, it's about mapping the English onto the concepts they already know. Some of those languages, they might have a written written system, but it's not alphabetic. That's okay. But it because what they bring to it in their language and the diversity that they hold is a depth of knowledge that then we're mapping the English onto. So, and again, we can't do that unless we're partners with our ELD, English language development teachers, and all of the educators interacting with kids.
You know, you've shown a really good light on the fact that language diversity and culture is really the norm, not the exception. And many people outside of education might view all of those groups as the exception to the process, when in fact they are the norm. And I think it's a really good point for us to shine a light on in terms of what the mission is at the local school district level, just given the amount of diversity. So, Christina, one last question. There's a term in education that's used a lot called continuous improvement, right? And what does that mean for Oakland schools and the kind of work that you do with individual districts?
So continuous improvement at Oakland Schools is really about getting better at getting better. So at the state level, Michigan Department of Education, they have a platform and a process called Michigan Integrated Continuous Improvement Process, which is the model that is used at the state level throughout the state. It's the model that we use internally for ourselves here at Oakland Schools to ensure that our services are continually growing, innovating, and meeting the needs of our districts and our schools, and it's also the process that our school districts use. So they look at what does their data say. They also lean into research for us in the area of literacy, but also research about implementation science and improvement science. What do we know matters when it comes to moving out of compliance and resistance and moving into internalization? So continuous improvement is really at the heart of everything that we do. do. Yeah. And in every, whether it is a small professional learning series that we're offering or a much larger scale project, we are continuously looking at data to make adjustments, to monitor and evaluate, to assess those needs. And it's really a continuous cycle. Those short-term data cycles really help to inform us at Oakland Schools about making adjustments to our service plans. And then a key component of what we do at Oakland Schools is supporting districts. So mm-hmm. taking guidance from MDE and helping support districts. And we really try at Oakland Schools to be as close to the classroom level, close to the student level as possible, because that's where we want to make the impact. Mm-hmm. Everything that we do is about making sure we're improving outcomes for students mm-hmm. and looking at that whole child. So continuous improvement is a term that's used a lot in education, and it's at the heart of everything that we do at mm-hmm. Oakland Schools.
You really did a nice job of explaining that. I love the phrase getting better at getting better, because mm-hmm. that really emphasizes the continuous nature of what we're trying to do. So Christina Carlin and Diane Katakowski from Oakland Schools, you've given our School Talks listeners a lot to think about as it relates to literacy in local schools, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
We'll continue our literacy conversation with Rochelle Barkley from Warren Woods Public Schools right after the break.
School Talks on WJR is sponsored by Wakely Associates, Point Moran Real Point, Collins and Blaha, O'Reilly Rancilio PC Attorneys at Law, and by Clark Construction. Now let's get back to class. Once again, your host, former Superintendent Dr. Robert Livernoy.
Joining us now on the program from Warren Woods Public Schools is literacy coach Rochelle Barkley. Welcome to the program, Rochelle.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So in our continued focus on literacy, I think it's important. In recent years, the term literacy coaching has grown in popularity, both from the state level and actually through funding mechanisms to have literacy coaches be employed in local school districts. And in your case, what does a literacy coach do for a local school district?
So in my role as a literacy coach, I support teachers in my building. I'm in a K-5 building, though we have coaches at every level. I'm a literacy coach in a K-5 building. So I support teachers in all ways, whether it's consulting to support with curriculum. Sometimes I may work to model a lesson. Sometimes we work collaboratively. If there are concerns with student achievement and student growth, we may explore data together. So literacy coaches really are there to support the teachers, whether they be new teachers or veteran teachers. I think there is some misconception about only teachers that are not doing a great job need coaches. Mm-hmm. And when we think about the role of a coach in any traditional way, all of the, even when you think about your best athletes, your LeBron James, Michael Jordan, they all have coaches. Mm-hmm. So your coach is there to work side by side. They may see things in your practice that you aren't able to see from your perspective, but really it's a partnership. So as a coach, I'm not an evaluator. The principals, the administrators are the evaluators, and it's really important that teachers know that it's not an evaluative role as a coach, because we really have to develop a relationship, a working relationship of trust. We want, as coaches, teachers to be able to approach us and be really consistent and be really vulnerable with the needs of their classroom and the needs of their practice.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you mentioned the difference between veteran and new teachers, and I guess what we would call their willingness to be coached. Mm-hmm. Let's just call it that. Mm-hmm. And I do know for many, many years, before technology became what it is, teachers were the experts. They were the keeper of the facts, mm-hmm. and it positioned them to be in a much more role, a much more authoritarian role as it relates to that information. And now, with the proliferation of information through, you know, an incredible number of paths, they've become more facilitators of helping children learn and identify things.
Yes.
And I think it's your point about this isn't about someone who needs help per se. It's more about facilitating a sort of a coaching process to how you can improve the profession. And through that lens, let me ask, if I'm a parent in your district, what kind of assessments or tools do you use to measure my child's literacy progress?
So, of course, we have our high stakes assessment, our state assessment. People may be familiar with NWEA. That's one of the assessments that is administered to students at all grade levels in the elementary grade levels. And then we have the MSTEP test, which begins at the third grade level. And those are what I would consider, what we would consider a high stakes test, those state evaluations. But we also have assessments, more formative assessments, assessments that help us to adjust our instruction in the moment. We do guided reading assessments. Those tell us a lot of information as teachers and coaches, how students are reading, how they're decoding, how they're comprehending, whether they're fluent. So we have guided reading assessments. We have unit assessments depending on your curriculum. And then that's also something as a coach that with a classroom teacher, we may develop an assessment. We may say, you know, I'm really worried about my children and their decoding skills. So we might do a word inventory or a spelling assessment, mm-hmm. and then maybe develop some guided grouping and instruction based off of that data.
Mm-hmm. From a literacy curriculum perspective, does the district use any particular curriculum or approach in the classroom, especially at the elementary level?
So we use a balanced literacy approach. And so with a balanced literacy approach, you have reading, writing, some word study, listening, and speaking. As the name suggests, it's balanced out. So it's not so heavily focused on one thing over the other. It gives some opportunity for whole language learning and instruction, whole group language and learning and instruction, small group learning and instruction, guided reading, read-alouds. So, and one thing that's important about balanced literacy is that the use of rich texts, rich literature, which is very important for students. It's very important for them to hear and to read rich texts. That's where a good quality read-aloud comes into play. That gives you an opportunity to have that experience mm-hmm. in the classroom.
So let's say literacy coaching is a lot more than just shooting free throws in practice.
Absolutely.
Rochelle Barkley, literacy coach from Warren Woods Public Schools. I appreciate your time, and I'm fascinated by the approach you are taking in Warren Woods Public Schools, and keep up the good work. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to thank our guests today, Dr. Michael Rice from the Michigan Department of Education, Christina Carlin and Diane Katakowski from Oakland Schools, and Rochelle Barkley from Warren Woods Public Schools. That's all the time we have, but remember, there are two ways to spell one and three ways to spell two. Till next time, this has been School Talks on 760 WJR.